You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 10. Thank you so much for staying with us. It is holiday vibes, isn't it? The Easter weekend is here. And many of us, of course, for us, it's the time to be with family. Unless you live in a country with junk status, where workers are maltreated. And then, you know, unfortunately, you might be caught up in strikes that prevent you from being able to go home this weekend, which is one of the horrible truths in South Africa. So politics never far away, even from a promised conversation about the history of Easter. And for many of us, it is also a very important time culturally and from a religious point of view. You're going to enjoy the next hour or so. I want you to call in, share with us as you listen to my guest, whom I'll introduce in a second, your experiences at this time of the Easter festival, the Easter weekend. I know, obviously, we live in a country of incredible pluralism, diverse religious, cultural, and other identities, beliefs, and practices. And we don't often do a lot to bring that to the fore. I was listening last night to a fantastic public lecture by Sir Sonkem Semang. I think the world over, a plurality of identities and a certain kind of cosmopolitanism is being shunned because of populist politics. And I hope what we can do here in a very subtle way as we talk about Easter and all the fun parts of its history is also to just pay homage to incredible diversity the world over and inside our own border in South Africa. And the person who's going to be doing that for us is Vashna Jagannath. Vashna is here with us. She's been on the show several times. Many of you, of course, know her. She does fantastic work as an historian. You've heard her talk about everything from contemporary politics to trade unionism. Those of you who read her, as all of you should, particularly online, The Con magazine, you will know that she has more range than perhaps on the topics we call her in on. And today she's here to talk to us about the history of Easter. Vashna, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Eusebius.
Isn't it lekker to take a break from Planet Zuma?
Yes.
Just a little bit.
Just a little.
Before we form new movements next week. And how are you?
Fine. Just overworked and looking forward to Easter.
I'm just glad you didn't say underpaid.
Well, you know.
I was fascinated when I first read an essay that you wrote about the history of this festival 2 years ago. And it's part of your interest, isn't it? Just as a curious creature, quite apart from your formal hat of historian. And how interesting it is when it comes to food, cultural practices, sense of place. There's always like there's rich histories that we often forget about.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And in fact, it's good that you mentioned this move towards populist politics, because in regards to this piece on Easter that I wrote a few years back, and I think two pieces on Christmas, It actually comes out of that. What I saw to be a closing down of the space around these festivals. That, I mean, I don't come from a Christian family, but we had Easter, we had, you know, hot cross buns, we had Easter eggs, all of the things. And, you know, these crazed right-wing Americans would go on and say, you know, keep Christmas Christian and all these kinds of things. And so I decided to investigate a bit about the history of these things. And like most, you know, rituals, cultural practices, it comes from a variety of areas. And it actually is not a WASP, for a want of a better word, as they would like us to think. And in fact, many of the people in the United States who want to claim these holidays for themselves during the Reformation, many Christians in the U.S. are Protestant, the Reformation banned these rituals because they understood them to be pagan. And so Easter specifically was banned. And in fact, probably that's why today it's not as popular in the U.S. as it is in Europe and in England and so on.
And that's one of the things that fascinated me. Vashna wrote, for example, early on in this essay, the following: this celebration of death and resurrection is viewed as a Christian holiday, but this movable feast has roots that stretch back into antiquity. And in fact, here's the interesting bit, far older than Christianity. That was certainly news to me.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's because Easter is tied to the spring festival and the spring equinox. That's why it's a movable feast as well. It's after the first full moon of the spring. And it's also, interestingly enough, tied to Passover, which is the liberation of Jews from slavery. And so it has really ancient roots. And throughout the world, they would have spring festivals, whether it was to Persephone, whether it was to Kali in India, and in Europe it was Esther. And that's where the sort of name comes from. And when, in fact, according to historical records, if there was a Palestinian man called Jesus Christ alive, he was not, I mean, he wasn't born in May, in December, but when he was killed, it wasn't about it being spring.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is interesting, though, is that it's tied to this very deeply. And that was because all the places they go to. So when Christianity enters, like Ireland, which it does much later. So Christianity enters into Europe much later than it does into Africa and into Asia. When it does, they find that there are pre-existing festivals there. And it's very difficult to get people to convert, to stop practicing those rituals. Mm-hmm. So they kind of... I mean, Christianity at its heart, and even it's at its best, is a religion of assimilation, of syncretism, all of those wonderful things that you want. And so what happens then is they like map it onto pre-existing festivals. So Easter and Christmas both are tied to pre-existing ancient festivals.
And these festivals, I mean, there was a wonderful passage from Ernest Hemingway. I'll find it now in a second that I really loved. I don't know if you still have it there. I think it's great. It's fascinating to me how a lot of these festivals have their roots also, it seems, in a sort of existential crisis about long winters of discontent that may not come to an end.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that we shouldn't negate that. We shouldn't negate the importance of seasons. I mean, now we live in a world where it doesn't really matter what the weather is like if you're middle class, right? I mean, if you're poor, it really matters because if it rains, you get flooded out of your home. But if you're middle class, it doesn't really matter. But I think that Hemingway, he writes so beautifully. I wanted to say poem, but it's not. Mm. But in his recollections around the waiting for spring, you get that sense sometimes, especially towards September, October, when the winter seems to be continuing. No, I don't.
Shall I read it? Okay, yes. I've got it right here. It's from A Movable Feast. He says the following, puts on reading voice. With so many trees in this city, you could see the spring coming each day until a night of warm wind would bring it suddenly in one morning. Sometimes the heavy cold rains would beat it back so that it would seem that it would never come and that you were losing a season out of your life. This was the only truly sad time in Paris because it was unnatural. You expected to be sad in the fall. Part of you died each year when the leaves fell from the trees and their branches were bare against the wind and the cold wintry light. But you knew there would always be the spring, as you knew the river would flow again after it was frozen. When the cold rains kept on and killed the spring, it was as though a young person had died for no reason. In those days, though, the spring always came finally, but it was frightening that it had nearly failed.
Mm-hmm. And it is frightening when spring actually fails. And there's been several instances in history tied directly to this, when spring has failed, when harvests fail. So that's also something I write about and tie into this. And I think, you know, for me, I'm very interested in food and history and culture and religion, but politics is never far away from it. And I think we have to consider that very, very clearly what this festival could mean. Because, I mean, at its heart, in its Christian manifestation, it has to do with the rebirth, the resurrection. Christ dies for the sins of Christians. I mean, he didn't die for my sins. I'm not a Christian, but, you know, he died for Christians. But he also was resurrected, and there was a new birth. And this allowed the Christian church to develop. I mean, Christ was not a Christian. He was Jewish. And I think that we find that over time, because the ancients also understood very well the rhythms of seasons, there are times when seasons change and when things are out of balance, or when seasons don't change and things are out of balance, like winter doesn't stop. And then you have, I mean, Shakespeare talks about it, is winter of discontent, right? And then you have what you have happening is a sort of change over of power. And in the French Revolution, you had this because the harvest failed and people were in Versailles busy celebrating and eating cake and living the life like people are doing in our country at the moment. and they weren't heeding. They weren't heeding to the rumblings of people. They weren't heeding to what was happening. And they had to pay a price. And they paid a price with their head, like the Romanovs did. So I think, you know, this moment should also be used, this holiday, this period should also be used as a period of reflection about its true meaning, whether you think about it from a purely Christian point of view or whether you think about it from a variety of other perspectives, such as, you know, its ancient roots, or even on a more just material base of what is happening, how things have been made out of balance.
Can we talk a little bit, Vashna, about geography? I wonder, because when I was thinking about, you know, these festivals, especially of spring, the fear that, that spring will not come again. Of course, winters are harsher in many of the European, the northern countries than they are here in our climate. And then the other thing is, I always find myself around this time, if I think about going away for the weekend. I mean, a couple of days ago, I did a 10-day weather forecast Google search to see which of the coastal cities will be the warmest if I wanted to leave Joburg for the weekend. So we are actually transitioning. We are experiencing autumn, and soon it is winter, and we're now debating whether winter has arrived or not. So why have we inherited the Easter festival? So that's just part of the history of how Christianity has inserted itself into our cultural life.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you asked that question, because it's not just Christianity. I mean, in Hinduism, there's a variety of mother festivals that happen at this period, and it happens in India, which is in the north, and it has to do with spring, and we don't have spring here. So we actually, in the south, have a bigger celebration in September, when it is our spring, around the same festival. Mm. So now people tend to do a much smaller one. But I think that, you know, Christianity hasn't just inserted itself into our lives during colonialism. And this is the kind of thing people often say, oh, well, it's Christian, it's outside, it's un-African, it's not part of us. I mean, Christianity develops in the Middle East. The first place it goes to is the Arab world, and that's where they get things like hymns, and the structure of the church and so on comes from pre-existing sort of rituals, probably out of Sufism and so on, that's in the region. It then comes down into North Africa, right? So it is in North Africa almost 600-700 years before it even enters Europe. So it has nothing to do with Europe. And so when people keep on saying it's this European religion that's coming and inserting its way, it's a bit problematic, I think. And I think we need to think about that, because Europe wants us to believe that that is the story, that they own Christianity. But when you unpick these rituals and these traditions, you see how it cannot possibly own it. Because in order for the tradition to even exist as it does and how we celebrate it, it has to have a global story.
That is so fascinating. Because what that implies, which is so true of a lot of our discourse, and again, the political echoes are very close to this conversation, is that the danger of rejecting some of these things as somehow a brave rejection of the colonial is that you are ironically reinscribing and recentering colonial history.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, for example, you can't, I mean, Easter eggs, right? Chocolate comes from Latin America. So until that was not introduced into Europe, they did not have chocolate as part of the festival, and it's not an integral part of the festival. Hot cross buns, which it's first said came about in the 14th century, needed dried fruit and spices, and the bun actually signifies the communion, the body of the Christ. And the spices it's wrapped in is apparently the same spices his body was wrapped in, is from the Arab world, because he was from the Arab world. And then the cross is obviously the crucifix. And so that can only come to Europe once it has the Crusades and bring back the spices. And that's when they start making this. And in fact, people believed it to have magical powers. So by the time you get to Victorian England, it's actually banned. You can only have it certain times. You can only have it on Good Friday at funerals and wedding, because people think with all the spices and everything has magical powers. So they don't actually, you're not allowed to make it the rest of the year. But I mean, all of these things has a global story to tell. And I think we often do that even with biomedicine. I mean, you know, the thing is, well, we have to reject biomedicine, which everyone calls Western medicine. It's not Western medicine. Biomedicine it comes from the global system of knowledge that we have. And Western medicine, if you want to talk about it, would be pre-modern biomedical systems, like you do traditional African medicine, Eastern medicine, and so on. So this the way in which we think about it, often we are re-inscribing colonial narratives. We are often inscribing, when we say we shouldn't celebrate Christmas or we shouldn't celebrate Easter because it belongs to Europe or the Western world, we are just, it's a, like a sort of Manichaeism. We are just taking on what the other side of the debate, sure, and saying, oh yeah, you said it's European, so we believe you, and therefore we'll take it on.
And now we're going to reject it, and we're so woke.
Exactly, exactly. And not realizing its actual deep history on this continent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stunning. Let's go to Kensington. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Eusebius. How are you guys doing? All right?
Very well. I'm hanging on to every word of our historian's stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to find out from Vashneshi, you know, on Friday, the 14th of April, almost every year, it's a Tamil New Year. We celebrate the Tamil New Year. Is there any similarities to Easter? Why is it?
Yeah.
Thank you, Nick.
I mean, that is actually because of the spring and the Tamil New Year. In fact, before the introduction of the sort of Gregorian calendar, most of the New Years were around this period. And in fact, in the old calendars, the New Year, even in Europe, was on the 1st of April. And that's how it becomes April's Fools thereafter. So it was, it had to do with spring and it had to do with the reawakening of the world and so on. And so, yes, even the Tamil New Year would fit into that because it has to be, it's tied to spring. It's also tied to mother goddesses and so on, which has to do with life and rebirth and fertility.
Mm. Can we talk a little bit? We'll go back to the lines in a second. And just, you know, you can just tell me whether you want to redirect, Vashna. But I was also fascinated by how the way in which we teach history, which is obviously your core intellectual and academic competency, we don't often weave it together so nicely with questions around geography, weather, and harvest. And you were also talking about how even events that we rote learn as kids, mm-hmm, like the various revolutions, the Russian and the French, that our teachers and our lecturers don't tell the full story, mm-hmm, of how even bad harvests can sometimes make an important cameo appearance in those stories.
Mm-hmm. No, I think so. And I think that's because when we think about history as a discipline, people want to think about it as a set of stories about the past.
Mm.
Right? And then sometimes
dates and big men.
Yeah. And then sometimes there's that, oh, well, you have to know history to know your future or some nonsense like that. But I mean, it actually is the case that there are groups, large groups of historians who actually think about history in terms of the present. So for me, history is my tool to understand my life now. And so in that light, whenever I'm trying to think through something, it's always with that lens on. So it's obvious. I mean, you know, the old history of the French Revolution didn't even consider women. It still doesn't consider women. In France, they have a big Bastille Day is the biggest celebration, which is on my birthday, the 14th of July. So I'm very excited about that. But This day is actually not the major day. The most one of the more important events would be the Women's March on Versailles. But we don't have this. We don't have these stories because it's skewed. And harvest is really important. Geography is really important. The fact that you don't have food to eat is very important. That's what pushes the women out on the streets in France, is that they have no bread to feed their family. So that was like the final straw.
Mm.
And it's something as, and the reason I think we often also don't consider it is because it seems like it's what we would call an act of God, a random act. So it can't be quantifiable. We can't study it. We can't think through it. But I would actually defer with that, because if you go back to the medieval Indian history and you think about the Mughal history in India, King Akbar, for example, had put into place a variety of systems that would avert droughts. So for the first time, the treasury did not belong to the king. It belonged to people. And areas that were drought-ridden and hit would receive all this money like we do now. But this was in the medieval India. And as a result, during that Mughal period, droughts and famines were actually limited. That's because he had a more egalitarian approach to how he was going to use his power and his wealth and his money.
That is so fascinating, because it brings us back to our daily real politic the world over. That when that harvest comes and we have this festival, it's not just a big sigh of release for us as ordinary folks, mm-hmm, and I go, phew, actually there's something to pick and to eat on and, mm-hmm, to celebrate. Mm-hmm. The fat cats themselves are saved by the season.
Exactly, like your bonus, right? The bosses are saved by bonuses, because you have like, oh my God, you finally have it, or month end. I mean, it gets even worse and worse as our situation gets worse. So they are saved, because we're not going to go on strike.
Absolutely.
We got paid again.
Let's take a couple more calls. Coffee, hello.
Hello.
It's been a long time. Welcome.
I know. Thanks, Jeremiah. This is a brilliant subject. In fact, one of the thing that's said is that geography governs history, in the sense that where you are will shape how you will see the event and how events will play out on you. So your environment is very, very essential. And you would see, I'm glad that your guest has mentioned a case in India,
yes.
But also there as well with the Emperor Ashoka, who third century BC or so, he understood that. And so understanding geography and history and how to govern, he managed to create some kind of federal state and decentralize the way people will be governed in a way that favors where they are much better than having a much bigger central government. And understanding that leaders, not just in the old times, but also contemporary leaders, must understand geography. It is so powerful, and that's why geopolitics and geoeconomics are essential tools for our people to understand the world should be governed and how people should govern themselves and create their own histories.
Beautifully put, Kofi. And I think that is also, on another occasion, we should, and I know you've also written about, you know, the history of schools and when it comes to beating our kids up and corporal punishment, the academy as well. I think we need to do a show on that, because Kofi is also reminding me there, Avashna, of the injustice we do to history, our history as human beings, by not having a synoptic approach towards history. Mm-hmm. As he says, geography, you know, is such a central part of history.
Mm-hmm.
And yet those are two different buildings. I don't even know if you know your colleagues in the geography department.
Not at all. I only know one geography.
It is amazing that geography, place, weather can be so important. We are actually talking politics.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's a whole school of Marxist geography that understands this very well, that we are talking about politics, we're talking about people's lives, and they have a much broader perspective. So you study a variety of things, and you study the impact of the environment and all of that. But it's not just geography. I mean, for most of history, women have been left out of the story, or black people have been left out of the story. So if you take, for example, the story that Europe and America tell of itself, it's as if its history develops completely separate to the exploitation and expropriation of wealth from Africa, Latin America, Asia, and the destruction of native populations of America.
Absolutely.
So it's like as if that history doesn't occur. So we really need to have a much better view. And that's why even something like Easter can be so revealing. It can teach us so much about the present. It can teach us so much about our traditions, about our religious practices, and so on.
Eusebius is on Twitter, at Eusebius.
Indeed, I'm speaking to Vashna Jagannath, who's an historian. We're talking about the history of Easter, more like the histories of Easter. And it is, as PJ Powers is rightly saying on Twitter, riveting. Can't get out of her car. I'm hanging on to every single word as well. Let's go back to the lines before we talk about eggs and bunnies. Wilhelm, hello.
Good morning, Eusebius, and your guest there. This is indeed fascinating. Yes, talking about eggs and bunnies, I wonder if your guest can also say something about the background of our tradition of eating pickled fish over this time.
That's such a good question. Does it come from the Cape Flats? I thought it's our festivals on some pickled fish.
No, it doesn't come from the Cape Flats. It actually has to do with the breaking of Lent, of fast. So when you break fast for Lent on the Friday, then you have to have fish. You can't eat meat immediately. It was considered to be too rich because you weren't supposed to have, I mean, the fasts, it traditionally were much more austere. You didn't like give up whiskey or chocolate or something. You gave up a lot of things. And that's why you have before that, you have, what's it, Shrove Tuesday, where you have like pancakes because you're using up whatever's left in the lard. And in fact, people think that's where the first English breakfasts, the notions of it come from, because people had to use up the pig and the eggs and all of that stuff. So they make this meal in like pre-modern times, early Christian times in England and stuff, they make this meal before Lent. And that's the start of the sort of English breakfast. And then when you break your fast, you have to have fish. You can't have meat. So that's where the pickled fish
And the pickled bit?
Because it's winter.
Oh.
And so you have to have your fish has to be preserved. And so there's all of those ways, and people often preserve them. And also it has to do with the fact that, you know, preserving fish, the tradition of preserving fish actually comes from the Jewish community into Europe. And they bring it. So like smoked salmon, which is seen as a like amazing Scottish heritage dish, or even fish and chips, which is seen as an English heritage dish, comes from the Jewish communities when they come into Europe. And because Jewish communities have always had to be on the move because of discrimination and anti-Semitism, they would often have fish that would be pickled or preserved in a variety of other ways, smoked and so on. Mm. So those traditions come into this through that.
Let's stay with the yummy subject. Where do eggs and bunnies come in?
Okay, well, bunnies come in. We don't, obviously, a lot of us eat. I mean, I eat rabbit, but we don't eat it at Easter. Right? It's not a traditional dish you eat at Easter. But the Easter bunny egg, I mean, the Easter bunny chocolate bunny, that comes out of symbolism of the bunny. So before the advent of chocolate into Europe, it would have been like a wooden figure for bunny and so on. And the reason for this is because the bunny was considered since ancient times to be hermaphrodite.
Oh, wow.
Because they've assumed that the bunnies reproduced themselves because they produce so much and so quickly. So people assume that they reproduced themselves. And so once the Christian church comes in, early monks and priests associated the bunny with the Virgin Mary because the bunny didn't have to break its virginity to give birth like the Virgin Mary. And that's why bunnies become a big symbolism. But interestingly enough, it was also the symbolism of Esther, who was the mother goddess, because of its fecundity, because it was so fertile and it was able to produce. And now the egg, obviously, is because it's life. So the symbolism of life and fertility, which has to do with spring. So new eggs, new chickens, all of these things are coming into life at this time. So that's how the egg comes into it. And the egg really has a very interesting history because, I mean, now we have all sorts of different types of eggs and it gets implicated or tied up to the Easter bunny somehow bringing eggs and so on. But, I mean, one of the things that I wrote about was the Russian Revolution. And just before the end, every year, the Romanov family would order Fabergé eggs for Easter. That's how the Fabergé eggs begin. And they would be completely ridiculously extravagant. I mean, at the last egg that the Tsar ordered for his mother, the Empress, was called the carnelian egg, and carnelian birched egg, sorry. And this was 12,500 rubles, which was approximately 52 times the amount of a worker's salary, a monthly salary in Russia at the time.
Wow.
And he didn't even have time to give the egg to his mother because the revolutionary forces had already began to sweep through Russia. But he was so unaware. He assumed that he had sort of appeased the Russian public in years earlier when he put in a sort of transition government. But he didn't. And he was unaware that the harvest was failing, that things were out of balance. And he orders this egg. And to the Russian people, this extravagance was just too much. And in fact, the egg had been lost for many years and was only found again in the 1980s because they didn't know where it was. And he never had a chance to give it to his mum.
I got this news the whole day. I think we need to start the history podcast with Vashna. Amazing. I'm just stunned. We'll just have a moment for that to sink in before we move on with the conversation. The bit that I loved when I was reading this in relation to, of course, the bunny was exactly, as you were saying, the connections there around the assumptions of it being hermaphroditic.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, Christian priests would use the idea of the hermaphroditic hare to represent the Virgin Mary, because like the hare, Mary, the mother of Christ, was thought to have produced a son without losing her virginity. I don't think I could ever eat an Easter bunny in the same way again.
But I think it's really important that we understand this, because we also then understand that people for all of history had an understanding of a variety of identities, that people exist in a variety of ways. You have hermaphrodites, you have a variety of genders. And people understood this. This idea that it just comes to us in the modern world and comes to us from particular individuals, so you negate people's sure. gender and identity and sexuality is ridiculous. It's actually built in Absolutely. To the very mythology of what it is you are doing. And many of the fundamentalists would say, oh, but we don't do this. But actually, your actual practice on Sunday and all of that comes from people having a deep understanding.
The virgin hare had a baby boy. This is hilarious. So many tweets. I'll get through your tweets in a second, but here's one from Levy down in Grahamstown who's listening to the show. I tweeted this picture of Vashna, and in the background is Richard. It says, lol, Richard sitting on the couch. Please give him a shout out for me. Yes, he's a very good, quiet ally there listening to his brilliant wife with her stories. Let's go to Santon. Jane, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I would love to know why it is called Good Friday, because clearly it wasn't so good for Jesus.
It didn't end very well, did it? Do you know the answer, Vashna? Because you know, now, of course, we've got millions of questions, and I hope you've got all your Chappies papers with Did You Know on it to answer every single one of them. Why is it called Good Friday?
I don't know why it's called Good Friday. What I do know about the Friday was that it was the day before the Sabbath, so it would be the preparation day, and that is why he was actually executed on that day, because it was the day to prepare the way for the newness and so on. But I have no idea why it's called Good Friday. But the one thing we do know is that it is possibly the only date, the only thing that we can be certain about in terms of the Bible, because it mentions it in the Bible that he was killed on this day, on the Friday, and it was the day before the Sabbath. So that's one of the things that we do know for sure. But I have no idea why it's called
that. If someone knows, please tell us. At least one person will know the exact answer to that question. Why was this day that was not very good for JC, why is it called Good Friday? I'd love to know. Let's go to Four Ways in the meantime. Esther, welcome to the conversation.
Hi. I have wondered about this for a long time. Why is Jesus always portrayed as white? Surely he should have a lot darker skin if he comes from Nazareth and around there.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's a really important question, Esther. It has to do, you know, okay, so historically, if at the time when Jesus is alive, he's the main sort of empire that is in control is the Roman Empire. And it's obviously an incredibly repressive empire, especially in places like Palestine, where Christ was from, and to those sorts of people. And we know all those stories about that. However, and when Christianity first begins, I mean, Jesus died a Jew, but the sort of movement around him comes to be known as Christianity. And in fact, it's not actually in the early days, in the first 200-300 years after Jesus' death, there's a lot of different stories about Jesus. There's a lot of different testaments and different texts that deal with Jesus, and they vary quite significantly. I mean, I think it's the Thomas, the testament. I can't remember. Is it Thomas? Yeah, that actually deals with...
We knew there was a reason Richard was here.
Yes, to nod his head. That actually deals with the fact that Jesus had a brother and that his mother wasn't, in fact, a virgin, right? So the stories from this early period really differ. I mean, even around Jesus's birth and death, there's early texts from North Africa from 247 AD, 247 years after his death, that tell a totally different story. So there was a variety of stories competing around this, and a variety of different ways to worship Christ. So, and there's, I mean, we see this still today in the Orthodox version of churches and so on. But what begins to happen is, with the fall of the Roman Empire, Constantine, the Roman emperor, decides to adopt Christianity as a religion. And the idea is that if Rome becomes the center of the Christian world and is able to spread Christianity through its empire, the apparatus of its empire, even though the sort of empire and its military might is in descendancy, it will still be able to control Europe through religion. And so what begins to happen is the new face of Christ is actually the face that we begin to have of someone like Constantine. Those are the early depictions that then come in. And in fact, in the Hagia Sophia Mosque in Turkey, it's actually, there's all of these murals, and it's, and it tells the story very well. And so you have this early image of Christ developing around the Emperor of Rome, and that's why he begins to get lightened. Mm. And then furthermore, once it becomes when Christianity becomes deeply implicated and a project that is used to legitimate colonialism, he then becomes even whiter, and he now has blue eyes and blonde hair and so on. So it wasn't always the case that Jesus looked like this. If you go to Europe, especially to Southern Europe, you have much more realistic representations of Jesus Christ on old churches, on in old paintings. I mean, when I was in Spain, there's fantastic statues, old statues of Mary in quite dark, made of quite dark wood and so on. So people had a variety of different images of them. But the blue-eyed and the blonde hair comes to be first through Constantine. There's a change in how he looks, a uniformed change. But then with colonialism, it becomes deeply implicated into the project of race.
Hmm, fascinating. I would have guessed, and it seems that's what most people are guessing, as Daryl puts it here and echoes many other tweets, it is probably called Good Friday, Eusebius, due to the fact that the death of Christ is for the redemption of mankind. Mm. I suspect that's probably why it's called that. Let's go to Cecil Burke. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Eusebius and the listeners of 702. Yeah, Eusebius, we have to remember that the coming of Jesus to earth was not about Jesus himself. It was about us, our redemption from sin, our healing through his stripes, the cancellation of our sins, were vacuum cleaned, vacuum packed, mm-hmm. and the death of Jesus at the cross. So it was not about him. He came as a sacrificial lamb for us. So it was good for us for Jesus to die and to fulfill his mandate and purpose here on earth. That is my answer. That is why it's called Good Friday.
Makes sense, yeah. Mm. And that's what a lot of people were saying. Thank you, Patrick. John, good morning.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Did you call my name?
I did.
I want to know something. Since you, the lady of history and geography, why is Christmas in December? Because if you're up in Israel and that, it is bitterly cold.
Yeah.
Why is it? Has it been moved or what?
Okay.
It's a very good question.
Yes. Well, it has been moved. According to those early records, especially I think it would be one of the earliest writings out of North Africa, which I mentioned earlier on, which is around 243 A.D., right, after the death of Christ. There's a document out of North Africa that puts the date of Christ's birth as 28th of March, right? And a lot of people agree with this because they're saying that it's bitterly cold. It'll be difficult for you to give birth in a barn. People are coming to, there's no story of snow and the coldness. There's a story of difficulty and finding a shelter and so on. So they say that it definitely was not at this period. But the early texts also don't place it in December. They place Christmas in March. Some even in August, but there's a variety of different dates around that. However, the reason why we have Christmas in winter is because it maps onto pre-existing midwinter festivals in Europe. And Christmas was actually not celebrated until it becomes, the birth of Christ was not celebrated until it becomes part, Christianity becomes part of the European world. And for much of Scandinavia, Norway, all of those Nordic regions, in order to get people to buy into this new religion, they had to map it onto the midwinter festival. And that's where you get Father Christmas coming from, the All Father. He was Odin, who would come and visit you and give you toys in the middle of winter and so on. So it comes from those traditions. And once again, it's something that's been mapped on. And what you find is during the Reformation, Martin Luther and all these individuals, they actually forbade their followers from practicing Christmas and from practicing Easter, because really? They saw it as pagan festivals. So they said we should not do this. And in fact, in England, Christmas was celebrated, but it was a very during the Protestant period, it was very mournful. And things like mince pies were even abolished because it was seen as a papal sort of decadence, because everything that had to do with the papacy was decadent and we were revolting against this paganism and decadence of the Catholic Church. And so you had a very austere sort of practice around that. And in fact, it was abolished in many places for a long time.
10 minutes before 11, let's take a quick break and then we'll get the final couple of your questions in this fascinating history of Easter.
Eusebius Mackayser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Bashna, let's take a question from Twitter. Mm-hmm. Bandile says, most religious traditions are centuries old, and you've done quite well to show how many of them also predate Christianity itself. Are there any new Easter or Christmas traditions that you know of? I think that's a good question. It actually also segues, I don't know how new some of these are. I mean, you mentioned, for example, in this essay that you had written 2 years ago, the Zulu fertility goddess, Mbaba Waresa. You also start it off by pointing the hat, not quite literally. This weekend, for example, we know many people will be going to Polokwane as a ZCC. So maybe we can also just bring it home. I don't know how what the histories are behind some of our own traditions here.
Yeah, I mean, I think we always... the idea that traditions and stuff are fixed is quite... I don't buy into it. I think we're continuously making it. And the story of Easter demonstrates that it's continuously made over hundreds of years. And for us here, I mean, we do a lot of things differently. For example, at Christmas, we usually have a braai and people are at the beach. It's not in the cold north and we're not having turkey and we're not having these kinds. So those are our new traditions. It's our new way of how we make it suitable to our contemporary lives. I mean, it's the only time people sometimes go to the beach in this country. And so the beach becomes of significance. It's something that you do. And so that is a tradition that we have here. You also have, for example... the sort of the way in which Christianity melds itself into local and sort of pre-existing African traditions and rituals. And that's what you have with people going to Polokwane and so on. So we do have a lot of those. And I think a lot of it is not, we don't overtly think of it as us making new traditions. Mm. Because what we often do in the now, we tend to negate. Or we tend not to take as seriously because it doesn't have the historical baggage of having an Easter egg and so on. But we certainly don't often have, I mean, I know people who would have pickled fish, but you don't have spring lamb, for example, because it's not spring and things like that. So I think in the food that we eat and the temperature, the clothes that we are wearing, all of those things would be different. And those would inform our traditions. And I think actually in a place like, I mean, I hate to say this because I don't like Australia, but in a place like Australia, they've really taken to Christmas in different ways. And they really take cognizance of their geography and the seasons. And they celebrate Christmas accordingly. And they make it an overt thing. We do it, but we still have snow paint onto things. True. And rather than embracing the fact that we are in a hot, sunny place and maybe we should be celebrating Christmas like a midsummer festival.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah. Let's go to Kisho, I think it is.
Hi, Zubias. Good morning, and good morning to your guests.
Good morning to you.
On one of my trips to India many years ago, and I was in Goa, and there is this painting in a church that depicts St. Christopher, but he's in typical Indian dress. That's wearing, your guests would know it, with what they call dhoti. Mm-hmm. And I inquired and asked the tour guide, and he says they have no clue as to how old that painting is, but it depicts in the times when there's 30 years of Jesus Christ's life that is not accounted for. And he was in India at that stage. Does your guest know in her research, did she find out anything like that in her research?
Yeah, I mean, I know of that story. In fact, there's quite a few claims that Christ, when he was, there's a period in his life that's unaccountable for in Christ's own life. It's a few years. And the idea was that he went east. And so there's often these stories that you get. I mean, even in Kashmir, for example, there's the Rosebal, which is the place where they say that Christ, that Christ went to and lived for a while when he was in India. I've heard the story. There is not enough historical evidence, if we had to think about it in terms of a historical text and Christ as a historical man, that he would have gone to India. But what we do know is that very shortly after the death of Christ, Christianity spreads very quickly, like I said earlier, into the Arab world, into Africa, and into India and China. And so very quickly, very early on, people have Christianity is already embedded in these communities. And the idea that it comes to these communities through colonialism is incorrect. And so a lot of these depictions would be people depicting these saints and these individuals who they're beginning to pray to in India in their own image. Mm. And people often do that.
Let's take a final question or comment. Gideon, thank you for calling in.
Hey, how are you, Eusebius?
Very good, thank you.
Great, great. I just had a question for the historian that you have there. And in the beginning of the show, it sounded like the way in which he was commenting, it sounded that Christianity was a very syncretic religion and coming out about. But there's a different perspective to it as well, that there are doctrinal truths that are founded in Christianity that point out these syncretic things that have come out historically that aren't supposed to be in Christianity, and therefore when we come to the Easter traditions, we know that something that has been brought in syncretically or something that has been brought out from the outside traditions, and we kind of separate that from the doctrinal truths in Christianity and actually see that this is authentic and this is what the apostles and the people who followed Christ actually taught. So that was just a point that I wanted to bring up with a historian that you have on the show.
Okay, fascinating.
Mm. Thanks, Gideon. Yeah, no, I mean, I think there is this question of doctrinal text and, mm. And ideas, and that's evolved over time as well. That's also changed. I mean, doctrinal, what was decided upon, for example, in 342 AD in Greece as to be part of the Christian text was very different to what comes later on. So those doctrinal truths also change over time. That doesn't mean that people should not believe in these doctrinal truths if that is part of their faith. But I do think that I have made it very clear that Easter traditions often were seen as being unchristian mm. at various points and by various different churches, and there has been clear separations. But the sort of popular understandings of Christianity and the popular ways in which around specific festivals of Easter and Christmas that a variety of things gets incorporated into it, people often don't make that discrimination. They often don't say this is unchristian, having an Easter egg, or believing in having a bunny rabbit is unchristian, or that Easter, even the word Easter comes from Esther. It has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. I mean, if it was Jesus' death, we'd have called it, I don't know, something else. Mm. It's Christ Day or something. Mm. So I think people are aware of that, and I was certainly not making a claim that it's not, that people are not aware of it. But I think we have to also understand that in popular understandings, it often gets pulled together. And Christianity itself then there is a case that it is syncretic, because even when Easter falls or when Christmas falls has to do with pre-existing traditions and rituals that are in place. So unless you even move that and change that, then, you know, we could have a discussion about purity and authenticity. But I think it's often not helpful. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have our faith in certain things. I think what Easter does is it demonstrates to us that we can change, that actually the true power of Christ was that he was willing to sacrifice himself, and that it has to do with ancient rhythms of the world that have to do with rebirth and renewal, and that perhaps over this Easter we should think about that and think about rebirth and renewal and revolution and change.
Vaishnav, that's been one of the most fascinating hours of radio in years that I've listened to.
Thank you.
And accidentally being the talk show host on it. So it's been an honor. Dr. Mabandla sums it up nicely with this tweet. One of the most intellectual, relevant, and yet simply and precisely made radio discussions there, Eusebius. Couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you for coming
in. Thank you.